everybody. Welcome to the Institute for Government for the third in our joint series with Nesta's Alliance for Useful Evidence and the National Institute for Economic and Social Research on the use of evidence and evaluation in policymaking. I'm going to hand on over very rapidly to our very esteemed guest chair in Best Have I Got News For You tradition, Jeff Mulgan, Chief Executive of Nesta, but general all-purpose person who's been everywhere in the policy world. He's going to introduce the panel. It's going to be the usual format. We're going to get you all out of here by 1:45 to go back to your day jobs. But anyway, it's really good to have you all at the Institute for Government now. And without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Jeff.
Well, thanks, Jill. Since this is an event with armchair in the title, I will stay sitting in my armchair and hope you're all sitting comfortably and digesting. As Jill said, for us, this is part of a program of work being done under the auspices of the Alliance for Useful Evidence. Some of you have been to past events. There's now 300 organizations as members of that alliance, focused really on improving the supply of evidence in all its forms. Yeah. And also the use and demand for evidence in everything from schools and hospitals and police forces to Whitehall departments and local government. All of that has immersed us in a world which many of you will be familiar with, of things like randomized controlled trials and systematic reviews and formal pilots and so on. But the whole world of evidence, I think like many other fields, is in a way in a moment of fluidity, with sort of competition and very different models of learning out and about, with many, as it were, amateur, citizen evaluators, users of data, a more open field, perhaps more contested about the meaning of different findings. And in one vision, perhaps, of the next few years, the provision of much more public data and administrative data as well as sort of outcomes data spawns an industry and a sort of a society of armchair evaluators who analyze things, spot patterns, lobby, and really change the way in which, I guess, public policy and our politics is done. And in one vision, they both influence the suppliers of evidence, the kind of professionals, the priesthood, perhaps of academics and others who in the past thought this was very much their monopoly, but also perhaps influencing the demand for evidence by making it harder for politicians and policymakers to ignore their findings. I mean, that's what we're going to explore today. We have a great panel from very different backgrounds, each of whom will speak for up to 8 minutes. First of all, we have Hadley Beeman from Technology Strategy Board and LinkedGov.org. We'll then hear from Kate Ebbett, Patient Opinion, then from Nadeem Zahawi, who's an MP and founder of YouGov, and finally welcoming Cathy Newman from Channel 4 News, who I think may have just been presenting it, which is an excuse for being slightly late. Let's start with you, Hadley.
Okay. I am the founder of LinkedGov, which is a startup incubating inside government, working on making all of the public data that's being published across the entire public sector usable to companies and individual developers outside the public sector. And I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. I'm also the open data lead for Technology Strategy Board, which means that I'm particularly looking at the economic potential of this data, how companies can engage with it, what they're doing with it, what they could be doing with it but can't yet. And looking to help communicate where those barriers are and stimulate growth as much as we can so that the vision will be realized. Because my background is as a technologist, I'm particularly focusing on not only the big picture economic vision, but also the implementation details, the challenges of why the vision hasn't come to pass quite yet. It began with the coalition agreement. Actually, it began before in the previous government, but was particularly crystallized in the coalition agreement, with the idea that all this data in the public sector can be published, pushed into the outside world in a non-personally identifiable form, such that it can be reused by anyone, that developers and companies would come along and take this data and produce their own tools, their own analysis and conclusions. Which is a great vision and one that I think we should hang on to and keep working towards. But there are some implementation challenges at each level. The first of which is on the government side, on the publishing part. Learning how to publish and learning what to publish is a pretty extensive process. Working out how to redact personally identifiable information, what is national security, what's not, how to deal with anonymized data, how to deal with data that's traditionally been charged for. These are all things that we're grappling with at the moment. And the data itself is of varying degrees of quality and conflicting or differing methodologies for different purposes. So if you're trying to use the data, understanding that this is a national statistic and we've put the entire weight of our economy behind it is an important bit of information compared to a spreadsheet that a team were using to keep a budget for an event, and it was okay if it was going to be off by 100 pounds in either direction. So as a user or a developer working with this data, there are a lot of challenges in receiving it from government. Similarly, because we have data coming from what amounts to tens of thousands of data teams across the public sector, it's coming in different formats, it's coming with all sorts of language and codes, budget codes and acronyms that are specific to that team and that group that are publishing. So from an outside perspective, it can be really difficult to work with that data or to understand what it is, never mind to technically aggregate it with data from other places to come up with these conclusions. And finally, producing something useful with this data depends on a significant number of specialist skills. Talking about armchair auditing requires actually some background in accounting, which I certainly don't have. I imagine most of the country doesn't have. And so there's a sort of interpretation and implementation layer between the data and citizens or companies or individuals who want to make use of it that we really need to build up. I think there's a big potential there to build products and services that people will pay significantly for, but we haven't yet seen the growth there that we'd like to see happen.
Thank you. Perfect. Okay.
So I'm from Patient Opinion. Patient Opinion is a place where patients can come and feedback about their health services online. We take these individual patient stories and we send them to just the right staff in the health service to help them to improve. They can publicly respond saying where they've made a change, what they've done as a result. I suppose my perspective on all of this is that citizen feedback, in our case patient feedback, is an incredibly powerful tool to improve change and hold services accountable in a very transparent way, particularly using the web. Firstly, I think this is a question of economics in some ways. Evaluations can be very, very expensive. Large scale evaluations, you know, cost a huge amount of money, take a lot of resources, but voice, the things people have to say, the feedback people have, has dropped to very little money at all. It hardly costs anything because it's online. Patients share their stories online, citizens share their experiences of using local council services, and it's all there for people to use. To take an example specifically from our site of what I mean by this is a service user of substance misuse services in the Northwest shared a story with us online publicly for everyone to read, where he explained that if his prescription for his drugs ran out on a Friday and he missed that appointment, being a chaotic service user, these things do happen, over the weekend he would have no access to services and have a very difficult time of it. This feedback was published and sent to not only the provider of that service but the people who commissioned that service. They were able to respond publicly. The service said, God, you're absolutely right, you know, actually, we're having to run an extra clinic on a Monday to make up for that. And the commissioner who pays for that service, so they pay for a range of similar services across the area, they also responded saying, oh yeah, actually, we need to change that for all of our services. Now, this is one person who's made a huge change for services across the whole sector, and it's somebody who would not normally be able to be heard from. It's a very powerful example of how one bit of feedback can lead to some very, you know, costly changes. And that's the point about this being web-based, is that it's part of a change, a social change, a culture change. People are feeding back. People are sharing their stories. Everyone's using the web to talk about their experiences. That's very, very powerful. that's a huge shift in the way people think about their voice. People used to only be able to share a story through their local newspaper publicly. Now they can do it online. So the power's transferred away from central government and back to the citizen in a whole new way. I'd say this is also about scale. Actually, it's very scalable to hear from people across the country, to get a huge range of interesting things from a huge range of interesting people. Our aim at Patient Opinion is to have 100,000 stories a year. At the rate of change that we get at the moment, that's 10,000 changes per year. We get about 10% changes at the moment. So that's 60 changes per trust per year. That's just one a week. But actually, if one trust made one change a week based on the engagement with patients online for a very low cost, that would help to revolutionise the NHS. So just to finish, my question to you is, how are you going to use these great new tools, these engaged people, to change what you do?
Thanks, Kate. Don't answer that question right now. You'll have your chance in a moment. Ready?
Thank you very much. That's a great sort of introduction to what I'd like to share with you, which is about the sort of citizen feedback. And I think before we discuss what can be done to ensure that citizens' feedback and scrutiny of public services moves forward in the future, we should also acknowledge its failings at present. First and foremost, we have to accept that the UK has been notoriously poor at citizen feedback. I think there was a recent report by PwC that said the citizen feedback in the UK public sector this year, listing us as, I think, one of the worst nations at taking into account the general public's view on the actions of government. The system, in my eyes, is broken, and it has been for a very long time. The key reasons for this is the way we approach people for feedback. At the moment, it is so unwieldy. It focuses on, you know, some of the controlled groups that you talked about. It focuses on the lobbyists. It focuses on special interest groups and not on talking to ordinary people and discussing their personal experiences of government and government services. The key thing is how you get ordinary users to really begin to share with you their experiences rather than those who are angry and shout the loudest. And I'm not saying that these organisations shouldn't, groups that represent user groups shouldn't feed into the process. In fact, in many occasions, they have their expertise and research of those special interest groups is quite vital to the process itself. But it also needs to be balanced with the views of the individual. So the question is how you allow ordinary people to get involved and feel that they can engage. Clearly, whatever the system put in place, it needs to be as simple as possible. My experience of this at YouGov, I absolutely think today, with the technology we have available, it is very much possible and achievable. So let me just sort of expand on that for a second. So let me give you an example. One way you can do this is through an interactive survey format that effectively pulls info out of people, but in a very friendly way. It would use simple questions and then could go further and deeper if the person involved is open to that. So if the consultation was about, for example, hospital wards, the survey could establish if you have been in a hospital, and then the question should be different than if you haven't been to hospital, for obvious reasons, and it could then use that very experience to quickly give you relevant questions, not blocks of questions that make you bored with trying to interact with government. In my experience in this field, people don't want to do lots and lots of surveys and pull lots of information about themselves. They have to actually have it pulled out of them and have to have the ability, if they really wanted to, then expand on that experience. And the reason that that sort of citizen feedback was not done in the past is because obviously it is cumbersome and very, very expensive. But we've already heard from the previous speaker that the cost has been massively reduced when the technology is available. And I think, therefore, it is vital that government begins to take advantage of this. One of the reasons that government, I think, has been reticent in taking advantage of this is that civil servants are very wary of this kind of service and actually face barriers that we all need to knock down. And the reason for their apprehension is natural. You know, their fear is that this would become another tool for the obsessive activists. It seems to me that at the moment, most public feedback leads to those who shout the loudest, getting the most attention, despite the fact that a large silent majority may think very differently about an issue. So for example, the e-petition system, though it, I think, is a great initiative out of this current government, they're really designed to allow people to raise the issues that concern them the most. Clearly it is for those who are annoyed rather than people who are sharing experience. You do not see an e-petition praising a government policy or discussing what changes could be made. But nevertheless, it is a very good start, and all new forms of public dialogue with government should be welcome. But it should be seen for what it is, a good start in a field where a lot more can be done and should be done. We now have the technology available to distinguish between people who are venting their anger and people who are discussing their experiences. There's a real fear in Whitehall that any new form of survey to pull out people's opinions would lead to an avalanche of extreme opinion. But it's my belief that this form of extensive view only erupts, this form of extreme view only erupts when people feel that they are not treated responsibly and are not being listened to. And we can separate these groups, and there needs to be a permanent channel in which people can express themselves to government. At YouGov, we already have the ability to do this. We previously worked with government on this very issue and did have a model which would allow us to get feedback and scrutiny from a huge number of ordinary people. The idea is really quite simple. Given the advances in the field over the past few years, I mean, let me just illustrate with a quick example. We could get a pool of about 50,000 pre-filtered people, allowing us to know their experiences and strong opinions on various subjects. We could draw people from this to give their opinion on anything at any time. Then we could draw from that a general population and balance sample so that we can test to ensure that those groups' opinions are in the mainstream. It is simple, and most importantly, has been proven in the field of opinion research, where firms already, not just YouGov, operate this particular process with great success. To me, the simple conclusion to all of this feedback is that government needs the platform to be able to accept that sort of feedback and act upon it. And that's the big challenge in the current climate. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed. Cathy.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, Fact Check was set up with a really clear mission in the aftermath of the whole kind of era of spin, if I can call it that. And our aim was to help viewers, users, citizens, whatever you want to call them, to scrutinise the claims of people in public office. So we'd had the dodgy dossiers of the Iraq war, and Gordon Brown had tried to kind of draw a line under all of that, and then he came a cropper when he went for a visit, I don't know whether people remember, to Iraq to visit the troops, and it was during the Tory party conference, and it was seen as a kind of a way of spinning things to his advantage, upstaging David Cameron's speech. So that all fell foul. David Cameron then, obviously, we had, he was cycling because he said this was, you know, part of him showing his love for the environment, and then we found out there was a car going behind with all his stuff. So he came a cropper. So clearly the spin pioneered by Blair is here to stay. And I think that's where Fact Check comes in. And it's surprisingly easy, I'm sure Nadim wouldn't want me to say this, but surprisingly easy to trip politicians up. So we caught out Gordon Brown lying to both Parliament and the Iraq inquiry about whether defence spending had gone up, and it hadn't. Nick Clegg, we found out, had used 20-year-old American research to claim that poor British kids heard 30 million fewer words an hour than their richer playmates, and you know, he just didn't stand up. And my favourite actually was David Miliband during the Labour leadership campaign said that his favourite restaurant was the Laughing Halibut Fish and Chip Shop on the South Bank, and actually he'd never been, he'd just sent his aides down there to pick up his fish and chips for him. So fact check, I think our fact checks divide into different categories. The easiest one is trying to cut through government spin or politician spin. It isn't always the government. David Cameron, for example, has repeatedly fiddled figures on how many private sector jobs there are, and his big claim is that private sector jobs are filling the gap left by the public sector job losses, and it just doesn't stack up. Then there's the kind of overblown claims, so things like a recent example, George Galloway said that his Bradford by-election win was the most sensational by-election victory in British history, bar none. And it was pretty sensational, but not quite as sensational as he'd like to think. There was a different one. The government always likes to trumpet the economic benefits of high-speed rail, HS2. And actually, there's one occasion where they used two different figures on the same day, so we were able to kind of skewer that. Then there's what I like to call government obfuscation. So, for example, the work experience row, how mandatory was that? And we were able to prove that it was rather more mandatory than ministers like to admit. And then very much in the area of citizen interaction and feedback, we do quite a lot of explainers on kind of complicated, quite nerdy subjects. So, for example, pensions. Quite a recent example, the BMA was claiming that nurses would lose out from the government's pension reforms, when in fact it was the BMA's kind of higher earners, the consultants, who were going to lose out more, as the government had claimed. So that was an example where the government was right, the BMA was wrong. And then we do quite a lot of adjudicating election spats. So we've done a lot of Ken Livingston versus Boris Johnson, you know, because actually the poor voter gets stuck in the middle. They don't know who to believe. There's all these conflicting claims coming out during an election campaign, and we're able to sort of help people find their way through that. So the fact check started as a blog, and we've built up some really loyal followers, both public and also politicians who, when there's a good fact check for them, like to quote us in Parliament, and when there's not, then they kind of forget about it. We've not fact-checked you yet, though, so we'll come there. And the things that generate most public interest are things, that policy areas that people care passionately about. So things like the NHS, we always get loads of hits or page views or whatever the terminology is now on the NHS. And I think also, just going back to what I said earlier, complicated subjects like pensions, we always get absolutely masses of people looking at that because people are confused about what to think, and actually to help find their way through that is what we're about. So as we've gone on, people have started suggesting fishy facts that we might want to look at through both comments on the blog, and also people tweet us and tweet me. So really, I think readers and citizens have helped to shape fact check. Another recent example, the work experience row. A reader had actually managed to save a cached copy of a document on the Department for Work and Pensions website, which helped to prove that the whole work experience scheme was much more mandatory than the ministers were saying. And I think through Twitter and also the blog comments, people who wouldn't ever respond to a government consultation and who wouldn't actually normally get in touch with a mainstream news channel are getting in touch with us. So on the tanker drivers dispute, the government says they're earning £45,000 a year. We had a tanker driver who tweeted us his payslip and proved that he wasn't earning £45,000 a year. And also we had a reader who spotted in the newspapers a World Literacy Foundation claim that 8 million Brits are functionally illiterate, and that was actually, we found out, based on 15-year-old research, so it was a bit like the Nick Clegg claim, but it's something that we would never have really sort of looked into if someone hadn't drawn it to our attention. So I've got a great team of fact checkers, a small team, team two, but they're great. Yeah, they're great. And they actually respond to as many blog comments as possible. So it's become a little kind of personal information service for people. And I think in all of this, for us, trust is absolutely crucial. And it's vital for us that we're completely even-handed. So during an election campaign, we actually tot up how many fact checks we're doing for each party, because we've got to be seen to be absolutely fair. And I'm sure Nadeem might complain sometimes, but I think if you looked, we do as many fact checks on Labour as the Tories in an election campaign. And I do quite like the fact that we've got a bit of a reputation sometimes for being a bit nerdy. I think that's all part of our trust and accuracy. So we won a Royal Statistical Society Award for the Gordon Brown Defence Spending Fact Check, which I think it's the kind of statistical equivalent of the Oscars. And also just one final thing, we've actually been going for 4 years, but it's only recently that I think that in Westminster, MPs have started to kind of really, some MPs have started to rely on us. And a Labour front bencher said to me that the best thing about being out of government was that he didn't have fact check on his case the whole time. Although I suspect it might be something to do with not having Gordon Brown on his case all the time, but anyway. If I tweet that I'm doing a fact check on something, quite often, within minutes, I'll get a call from the relevant government department. So I sort of feel that that's where we're doing our readers a really good service. If they want to know something, we're going to find out as quickly as possible and tell them about it.
Well, thank you. Thank you all for keeping to time and very clear expositions. We've got, in some ways, a series of overlapping territories the panel have talked about, opening up public data, qualitative feedback on experiences, there's aggregating citizen perceptions and views, etc., and then how do you ensure the whole kind of ecology of policy is kept accurate and lies are kept in check. I'd like to ask each of you very briefly, perhaps to give one example of how any of this has actually changed action or policy by government at any level in a surprising way, and then we'll open up for comments and discussion. In particular, perhaps how these different things might fit together looking to the future, the open data, the qualitative feedback, aggregation, the role of the media. So it feels like we're in a period of transition to quite different systems of organising information and knowledge. But just, are there any examples you'd like to share of where the things you've talked about actually achieved a material change in action in a surprising way?
It's still very early in the open data policy environment, but we've been through three distinct consultations now, two on different iterations of a public data corporation to organize and make more use of the data that's being sold, and one around open data in general, and particularly the concept of a public right to data, and what sort of legislative ramifications that has. We're now in a open standards consultation, which is taking on board all of the existing activity in the technology world, which affects how government manages its own data and how it prepares stuff to be sent out to the outside world, and also how it engages with suppliers. I suspect that the open data agenda has been particularly surprising on a policy level because it has caused so much interest and because it has generated so much activity in the financial world, in the private sector, in the activist world, in the media, citizen engagements. It really has provoked an awful lot of interest. And then an awful lot of input into government as to which data should be prioritized for publication, how it should be managed, how government should think about changing its relationship to citizens. We're having to look at things like changing press offices to be able to answer questions about cell A35 on a particular spreadsheet instead of answering questions about something someone has read or something they've heard. So I think it's been a much bigger policy initiative overall than I suspect anyone expected.
It was just last week, was it, the International Open Government Transparency Partnership was launched, There, I think the UK sort of presents heart surgery as the case study, Bruce Keogh, how making transparent heart surgeon survival rates improved performance by up to 50%. Now, interesting that it had no involvement of policy at all. That was just the practice and didn't actually involve citizen aggregators, analysts. It was just a profession taking hold of data. Well, what example would you share?
It's interesting. I'd say that we're probably talking about a shift in culture from our perspective, in that we've been going for about 7 years now, and when we first started in the NHS, if you said to somebody, we want to publish some feedback about one of your services, everyone would probably faint and say, you know, what? How can you possibly do that to us? And the first responses we got from everyone in the NHS publicly was to say, please contact our PALS department. And that was the standard response. And the shift has been very cultural rather than policy. I think we're now starting to see it borne out in policy as well, in expecting our staff in the NHS and presumably other sectors to be much more open and honest and able to engage and be less intimidated by public transparent information.
Okay, Nadine, one specific example?
It's very difficult because obviously this is all so new and government use of it is so, I guess, embryonic at the moment. So going back to my days at YouGov, one of the interesting sort of bits was the regional assemblies. And some of the work we did on that was where we took a representative panel of people, asked them sort of top of the head reaction, and it was very positive. They thought it was a great idea. And you sort of can see why government would have sort of gone ahead with it. But then when you split the sample and go through both arguments, very fair, we asked both campaigns to give us their arguments. We took them through the arguments, so we mimicked effectively a campaign. You saw an enormous shift away from support towards disapproval. And that sort of work needs to be going on all the time, I think. You know, the technology's in place, I think you can do that sort of thing so that you stop wasting lots and lots of resources, time, effort, money on stuff that actually eventually ends up going the wrong way for you.
Cathy, you've obviously embarrassed lots of ministers. Have they changed policy as a result of her fact?
Well, I know I keep on banging on about this, but the work experience row, I think, from our readers' cached document to just people in, job seekers who were going into job centres and they had letters that they emailed to us saying, using the word mandatory, I think then the DWP changed this document so the reader who'd kept it, it was then updated by DWP and they tried to pretend that they'd never had the original document that he'd sent up. But I think they did then change policy and made it clear that the work experience scheme was not mandatory. So it's a small thing, but I think that was one way in which citizens helped change a policy.
Okay, let's open up for questions, comments, but also it'd be interesting to hear other examples of where you think in some ways the role of policy assessment, evaluation, feedback has moved out from being just a monopoly of perhaps the formal evaluators, academics, government departments to a wider set of the public. And David, if you could each introduce yourselves.
David Walker, Veritas, one of which is the ESRC, which is a partner in the Alliance for Useful Evidence. Slightly surprised none of the speakers has overtly mentioned the age of austerity. Danny Alexander speaks this morning reminding us about the fiscal agenda. What's the connection between this open data type activity and reducing the state? If you ask patients for more feedback, it's highly likely they're going to say more. And if you go along, you're going to... It's interesting, isn't it? The NAO reported last week that so far there's very little evidence that the armchair auditor of local government's output of data has used that to do what the government obviously intended, which was to cut back, to put pressure on local authorities to do less. All the drive at the moment seems to be to do for the government, as a result of more open data, to do more. Question.
So we've heard a bit about how some of these things may be cheaper, though neither of you said whose jobs would disappear as a result of all the savings achieved from automated feedback. And then there's in some ways the bigger issue about citizen engagement likely to generate more upward pressure on public spending? Yeah.
Hello, Felix Greaves from Imperial College. I'm a public health doctor, and we do a particular line of research where we compare crowdsourced data, for example, from NHS Choices, people's rating of their care, with standard data from the NHS, things like the patient surveys and quality metrics. We found some really reassuring things, such that hospitals that patients rate well online tend to be the ones that have lower mortality rates, lower MRSA rates. And it matches up quite well to the really expensive surveys that we do at the moment. So there's a potential way you could think, well, there's a bit of overlap here. We might be able to save a bit of money. At the same time, we also see that people doing this rating tends to be people in wealthier areas, people in urban areas, younger people. So you're creating a really biased source of people that you're asking if you just allow free-for-all feedback. So in some ways, yes, it does relate to what we see, but in other ways, we're not necessarily asking all the people we should be.
Here at the front and in the third row.
Clive Bates, I'm a Welsh civil servant on secondment to DEC. As well as improving the quality, the channels and the quantity of feedback that's going back into government public services, do you also need to do things that sensitise public services and government to react to that feedback? So for example, feedback from someone who is carrying their own budget may carry more weight, or someone who could choose a different service may carry some weight, or an organisation where the feedback goes is presented to the board, synthesised and presented to the board, or where you create peer pressure, which I think was the basis of the main driver on the heart surgery thing, Jeff, was the fact that surgeons compared with each other rather than, or the police example in the United States, I think crime mapping there worked because the police stations were comparing with each other. So is there a parallel reform agenda to be had along with this that makes the whole thing work better?
Hello, my name's Adi Adiwumi. I work with the Cabinet Office. My question is around, I think, the points that at least two speakers have made around scalability. And I see how, from a data collection point, it's scalable. I see how the cost there has gone down. I'm not so sure how scalable it is on the processing side. So there's much been said about the fact that we can now gather this information. It places a demand on, especially because people want feedback. So once they give us this information, they do want some sort of response. There's a resource issue on the processing side. I think there's also a data skills issue as to, so for example, say we are doing some sort of social media monitoring and we're assessing, we're actively listening to the kind of things people are saying. How do we, the processes are clearer, I guess, for the surveys we do at present as to how representative this information is. I'm not sure that the skills exist sufficiently within government to do the same for the information we get via these alternative means.
Okay, let's take some responses to that, to those. Perhaps kicking off with austerity. How is this going to save money?
Well, one way, and
no more regional assemblies, obviously, you've achieved that already.
Again, so with my UGOP hat on, one way you save money is I remember being asked to give independent evidence to a committee, and I turned up to this thing, to being the CEO of UGOP, and they had already commissioned very expensive market research for the committee for its deliberations, and this great sort of tomb sort of landed on the desk. And as we started to go through it, they very quickly realized, I wish we could go back to that particular group and just ask them a little bit more about this particular issue. And I just found this whole thing was like living in a parallel universe, because all this stuff now is so much more efficient, so much cheaper to do. And to my amazement, when I was sort of leaving, I asked how much the research had cost, and it was something like £289,000 for a sample of 1,000 people. If I recall correctly, with the analysis sort of on top thrown in. Now, in the new world, that should not cost anything near that figure. I mean, it is a fraction of that cost. So you can already begin, if you drop some of the sort of prejudices around market research and around sort of online research, you can certainly bring the cost of that inside government to a much, much smaller figure. I do see the point being made by the lady from the Cabinet Office, i.e., what do you then do with that? The organisation has to be set up to be able to handle that data much more efficiently because there is so much of it. So once you've got over your sort of your prejudice that you know this stuff is representative and can be made so that you can action it, well, how are you going to action it? What are you going to do about it? Who are the individuals doing it? So you need a sort of a reorganisation of the way government works to be able to handle that data. And I think that is really the sort of the big challenge here. And sometimes we sort of hide behind.
When you say reorganisation, but that sounds like new people you're going to employ, more cost.
Well, no,
with all these data skills.
Not necessarily. I mean, you've just got to basically step back and say, well, okay, so what does this really mean? Why are we doing it? Is it just sort of to put it on a shelf somewhere? Then if it is, then let's not do it. If it's actually to make people's lives better, then let's do it. And the more transparency you have on that side, I think, back to your example of heart surgeons, the better it is. So if people can actually see what government's doing with this stuff, will actually make government more efficient.
The question about sort of new biases, that if you have more open source feedback, that tends to be better educated, younger, more metropolitan. Do you think that's an issue in this whole space, and how do you counter it?
Yeah, I also think, someone mentioned earlier, I can't remember which of the speakers it was, just about how it's whoever shouts loudest gets heard. And I definitely think there's a real issue there, that there's this kind of generation of bloggers and tweeters who are quite, I think, well, this, I haven't done an extensive survey of this, so don't fact check me on this, but it seems to me that it's more likely to be male, and you feel that it is a certain type of person is overrepresented who has a kind of bee in their bonnet about particular issues. So I think there is a danger there of getting a bias, definitely. And, let's not forget that a lot of elderly don't have access to computers that we all take for granted. And so if you're looking at saving money as a government, there's a limit to what you can do in terms of online consultation and that kind of thing, because I think you are going to end up getting a bias.
And who did you get in patient opinion? What sort of people actually used it?
Well, the example that I gave earlier of the service user who was using a substance disease services, that was actually feedback that we got through service user representatives in the service who sit with people who haven't got access to the web. So that's the expensive bit of what we do, in that it's less expensive because we get volunteers to do it, but actually, to some extent, the hard-to-reach stuff, that's hard to do in a cheap way, because ultimately we're using the people who are all online to make it cheap. So the bit that does entail kind of cost and involvement for us is definitely that reaching out to people, but we know it's really important, so actually it's worth that bit of extra spend.
Can I just come back on that very quickly? Yeah. I just want to burst that myth. What is amazing is that someone as technology savvy as fact-checks still thinks, because, and that's natural, by the way, I say it's amazing, but it's also natural human behaviour, that we still think that, elderly people can't really be online.
Some can't.
Well, YouGov's model wouldn't work. We wouldn't be able to be so accurate at calling elections if we didn't reach those exact people, the very old, an old lady living on a Doncaster housing estate who may access the internet through her free library service. It will be different, by the way, to her neighbour, who doesn't have access to the internet in the same way when it comes to technology issues. So when you ask them about technology, they'll differ. But when it comes to other issues, including political questions and government services, there isn't a huge difference. And you can actually model for that, because of what we all do in our industry, in sort of market research or polling, is that we're creating models. And now the technology is...
You adapt the figures to get them to be right.
No, we don't. What you do is...
But you do it in a way.
You create a model that delivers that. And by the way, at the end of the day, whether it's YouGov or any other company, you effectively test yourself in general elections, local elections, European elections, so on. Yeah. And so that's gone away. So the challenge now is, how do you take advantage of that without sort of always being held back by the idea, it can't be the same as offline, which costs so much more money.
I mean, it's an intriguing thing about polling, that in order to be more accurate, it does do something different from what the public thinks it does, because they think you just do a poll and you publish the sample, but in fact you adjust everything. But can I just pursue Clive's question, which is about the capacities needed in public organisations to cope with feedback of different kinds? My memory when patient opinion started is most bits of the health service sent everything to the legal department for fear of acknowledging any problem would sort of create a case. So what, both of you maybe comment on this, what kind of skills do you need in government at every level to be able to cope with the sort of stuff?
Just to pick up on that, which is absolutely right, which is that the first reaction with all NHS organisations to public feedback is to freak out and put it through to some centralised department. The goal of what we do is to get it to just the right staff, which addresses both your question about scalability and the question about lowering the cost. If you get it to the person who delivers the care, who runs that, manages that ward, and give them the training to be able to respond, which is a bit of an investment, but they can then respond, you know, I run that ward, I can change that, that's absolutely fine. If you give them that freedom as a staff member to be able to do it, change it, and tell everyone about it, that really changes the way that your staff do that, and it reduces the cost hugely. Also, we'd reduce the cost of litigation, because patients who get a good response publicly through us don't sue.
I'd like to hear at some point from anyone who thinks any Whitehall department has yet done what you just described.
I already mentioned that the press offices are starting to change how they're interacting with the public as a result of this data coming in. I think that's an entirely new skill set. But one of the things that particularly interests me is how much I've worked in the NHS, in local government, and in several parts of central government. And everywhere I've been, and everywhere I've been lucky enough to speak to, or everyone I've spoken to, there is at least a team in each organization whose job it is to cope with data coming from other parts of the public sector, to benchmark, to bring in input, to hand off citizen contact, whatever the situation may be. But they are all duplicating each other's efforts just to make sense of the data they're getting in order to integrate it into what it is they're doing in their own organization. So I think there's huge efficiencies to be made. The more that most of this data is published to the outside world, and the better we get at publishing it sort of to the world at large, the public sector itself is a user of the data, and that's going to save an awful lot of work and, as you were saying, jobs.
So whose jobs will disappear?
The technologists who are trying to clean the data.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's take another round of comments, starting here and here, at the far right at the back.
My name is Hans-Peter Ulrich. I'm an independent policy consultant. I think that there seem to be two questions about this. I personally believe that we often do substantial statistical research about things and don't get to the ground of it, and asking people what do you think about this service seems to be very good, and I think politicians should do that more often. But with respect to the system of armchair evaluators, I think we have to ask what can armchair evaluators actually achieve, in contrast to the question, what do we as a society want and need to achieve? We as a society need to make government effective as possible. So in which way do armchair evaluators, let's say in the NHS or in another specific area, unemployment policy, contribute to the overall goal? I think what we find is we only get patchy information on certain issues. There are other issues that don't have armchair evaluators. For example, one issue that I always find very intriguing is that on our global oceans, there are carpets of plastic rubbish the size of the middle of Europe. I think nobody here in this room likes that idea. We all find it horrible. But still, there is no armchair evaluator that sits there and says, look, I don't like that fact. It's because we are not directly concerned by these things. We don't see them. They are not in front of our doorstep. So, yes, we want policy to be effective. Armchair evaluators might help to do that, giving certain feedback, but they don't cover all things. They don't cover the effects of biogenetic medicine on the population. That's something which is far in the future, but which begins today. or what's another thing, or certain policies that affect the future of our children or so.
But just keep your mic. I mean, one of the fields which armchair evaluations have progressed furthest was astronomy. About as distant from daily life as you could imagine, where thousands of people were able to discover stars, spot correlations, which the scientists weren't able to do. What do you think would be a really good example of a policy field where armchair evaluation could have an impact?
I would have to think about it.
Okay.
Neil Nerva, Frontline Consulting Associates. The cynic in me is depressed by the story about the Drug and Alcohol Service, in which it took someone having to expose, effectively, something which should have been good practice anyway. And to what extent did they change because they're a learning organisation or because they had been exposed? And were they, anyway, scoring excellent for feedback on consultation? And has there been... No, seriously. And have you been able to follow up almost and drill down with that user or globally as to was it just one instance or is it wider? And has that been shared in terms of evidence of practice with other drug and alcohol services? Because I think that leads on to the point about sort of a public sector trip advisory is one thing, and having been on the back end of it almost, you can imagine you see a lot of negative stuff. How do you, apart from the point about randomization and is it typical, how do you move, I'm asking the panel this, from the retrospective to the proactive? Because I think people are as interested in trying to shape the future, which isn't always about maintenance of the status quo, thinking of health service reorganisation in a completely bipartisan way about development of pathways. In order to do that, people have got to in order to make informed choice, you need a real set of information. And public bodies need to accept there is debate and not just long delays whilst the bill is passed. There's been lots of feedback which says something different.
We'll take two more comments, one at the back. And maybe just to slightly reframe your question and ask the panel to think about it, is whose job will it be to put together the individual cases, the feedback and so on, and larger patterns of evidence and policy issues? Because a trip advisor may not be a brilliant tool for changing the direction of a whole country. But it's not clear whose job it is to put the pieces together. Yeah.
Hugh Lloyd, in a sense it follows from that, and your point about Whitehall, it feels to me that there's a mechanism for engaging feedback for those people who deliver services that all of us could probably see would be very effective as long as it's linked to the people who are actually providing something, because it's about their understanding of what they're doing, getting feedback on it, making it work. So my question was more in the territory of how far do you think politicians can and officials in the civil service, because the civil service is in a sense by extension part of the political domain in a different way to deliverers, to what extent do you think they can ignore public views and public feedback? I mean, some politicians have been quoted as saying as they don't believe in evidence, so clearly they think they can ignore anything and everything. But they might also be the places and the people to spot the patterns. So it's a sort of double edge. So how far do you think people can choose what they respond to when they're politicians?
And at the front row here, yeah.
Adam Thorpe, St Martin's College of Art and Design. Just interested in what our colleagues from Imperial here said about checking crowdsourced data and the fact that it does correlate, but it comes with a specific demographic, potentially. And similarly, the fact that patient opinion makes the effort to go and assist those that wouldn't naturally find themselves able to contribute this data online to do so. I'm following some work of a PhD student in Paris, Gudiani Roth, who's looking at effectiveness of the crowdsourced ideation platforms. Dell's IdeaStorm's a good example of one. And what they've noticed is that actually, over time and over sort of serial submitters, the quality defined by that which the commercial organisation sees worthy of implementation and gaining benefit from, actually reduces. So the solution is, as far as they're concerned, what they're saying we need more of is we need more people and we need more diverse people contributing to these platforms. So that might play out in this sort of social innovation as well as market innovation area that we're talking about. And another thing that I found interesting about patient opinion before I pass back, I'm interested in what you think about this, is when you start to target specific individuals that are users of services with specific individuals within service provision in environments and enable those people within the provision environment to respond and collaborate with the person that's got the experience of their service, then that to me starts to look like opening collaborative sort of co-design platforms for service in a way. And I find that very interesting from where you're going now and the targeting of specific individuals' experience, specific individuals can do something about it and giving them the power and responsibility to do so. That's very positive, and I'm interested in what comes next.
Great. Okay, well, some very good questions. I can't summarise them, but maybe we might start off with ask the panel in our last sort of 10 minutes or so for a picture of Whitehall. What might Whitehall look like that was doing all this stuff really well? What skills would it need? What structures? Still letting politicians, if they choose, ignore all the evidence and all the feedback. That's their prerogative. But is there a picture of where we could be in 5 years' time if all of this was done really well?
I think, actually, politicians are quite engaged in this process. And it could be that it comes from, the initiative comes from politicians with civil servants that actually sort of tips towards actually making all the stuff we've been talking about a reality. I'm beginning to see it in select committees. Select committees are important because they are, you know, those committees are scrutinising the work of the various departments, and therefore both the civil servants and the executive, the ministers, do take them seriously. And a couple of the select committees have got engaged in this process in actually building panels in the way I described in my presentation that are representative, that get over the whole, you know, issue about. Is it just the people who are shouting the loudest who are engaging? And that work is really just beginning. I'm talking about, you know, it's really been going months rather than years. So I suspect you're going to get sort of a push from politicians for more of this sort of stuff. And I think also things like patient opinion, that sort of work will begin to resonate. You know, how will it eventually work? I wouldn't even sort of attempt to try and guess. I wouldn't be arrogant enough to know how it would work. But actually, you know, as long as we're making sure that we're sort of the decision makers at the end of the day, the politicians are actually engaged in this, that's where it really should start from.
Would you require every senior civil servant to have done a statistics course?
No, not necessarily. This is the whole thing. You know, we sort of, in our minds, there's all these barriers to using some of this stuff. The reality is, you know, as we've heard with patients' opinion, once you see the benefits of it, and by the way, on the other side of it, which I think is important, is the transparency. You know, if people can see what you're doing with that information, it does make a massive difference. So the reality is, the way you change culture is by making all this stuff transparent.
Can I build on that?
Well, in a second, let's ask Cathy first.
I mean, what I think is great about all this is it makes government more accessible to people, as long as they're not, you know, the elderly ones who aren't on your YouGov panels who don't have email. But anyway, you know, because it's much easier to email your council than hold on the phone for ages or email a central government department. But I think that the challenge for government is that's the kind of workload, and it may be that you end up kind of just shifting the deck chairs, as it were, because maybe the people who sifted through all the print consultation now do the same but online, and maybe you have the same people just doing different jobs. But I think from a political point of view, I can see the extra workload in terms of responding to Twitter, responding to constituents online, and I feel it myself, you know, I always ask viewers to tweet me and all of that, and I feel that I want to respond to as many as possible, unless they're abusive, obviously, which I just ignore. But I think MPs who go down the route of getting someone to write their Twitter feed, I think that's very difficult, because the whole point is the personal access.
What was the fact on that? What ratio of MPs?
Still working on it, yeah. But, you know, I can see, I don't really know what the answer is to that, because I can see that it produces a whole load of extra work, this new interact, you know, it's great for consumers in many ways, but it's very hard for the practitioners.
And just a couple of things to mention. I think that 5 years from now, we're going to have to look towards building up that layer of analysis and building conclusions and aggregation that we've all been sort of dancing around, regardless of whether this is information coming from other parts of government or coming from citizens directly. Where does it go? What's done with it? How much of that is done with technology? There'll definitely be new business processes to accommodate that. And new sort of societal expectations, new relationship between the citizen and the state. And a lot of that to me hinges on expectations that we really haven't explored, I don't think, as a country. I don't think we have a very clear sense of what we as citizens expect from the spending of our government, for example. We can set some high-level goals of efficiency and appropriate spending, but what does that actually mean when you look at this council's spending from last month? Is the data appropriate for coming to those conclusions, or do we need to be publishing it differently? And then there's an awful lot of complexity within government departments, within councils, within the NHS that do affect citizen-facing services that we may not be as good about being transparent as we could be, but that's a significant amount of work as well. Can explain to someone that the reason their response was delayed to their complaint was that, I don't know, there's been a reshuffle of leadership and whatever else it is that's going on behind the scenes, there's a significant amount of almost opaque walls that exist between the public sector and citizens very often. And opening up the data is one thing, opening up information through the existing channels is great, but how much does the citizen need to know or want to know, demand to know the intricacies of the inside? And I don't know that we've really sort of sorted that out expectation-wise across the board. So I think 5 years from now, that's going to be something to take into account. I don't know if we can predict it at the moment.
Kate, is the logical evolution for you to get into essentially co-design, away from feedback towards reshaping the front line of service delivery?
I was just thinking about what that would look like. That our premise has always been that public stories are useful and powerful, and having them there is useful and powerful and helps drive services. We've obviously used some of those service users and put them in contact with services in order for them to be able to make sure that they deliver better care. We've gone to sort of practical things, but how you create an online tool that helps you do that, that would be a fascinating thing to explore. And if you'd like to talk about it, do get in touch. It'd be something we'd absolutely love to work out. In terms of, I was just sitting here trying to think how we would impact on policy, and actually I was sort of thinking that policies come and go, but patients and the NHS, they stay, you know?
That's a very reassuring message.
and we're improving services at a service level with staff and patients directly, and that's what we do, and some of that will impact up on policies, and sometimes there are policies that say you should listen to patients online, like patient opinion, and sometimes there aren't, but actually the real ground level stuff is what we do.
Well, there's a question of granularity in all of this. See, the plural of anecdote is not statistic,
yes.
And you know, just want to aggregate anecdotes, but equally for the design of a very local service, that may be the most appropriate thing to do.
Absolutely.
We've got time for two very short comments, one here and one there, just a sentence or so each.
Yeah, just responding to some of...
Could you introduce yourself?
David Nita from ELECT. Responding to some of the comments that's been raised about the responsibility to bridge the gap between policy and collection of data. Well, you know, Kate and I, we were talking before the session, and I wasn't even aware of patient opinion. It so happens that I'm doing work on Broadmoor Hospital, and I'm not sure, but I doubt that anybody from that secure unit, mental health unit, would have interacted with patient opinion. Point I'm trying to make is that now they will. I'm going to fact check it, by the way, just to make sure whether or not they are. But the point is that they will now, because of my interaction with Broadmoor, I'm going to see to it that there is a line of communication between some of these armchair organizations that measure and people who don't access it. There's a point that raised that how far does this go out? Point I want to make is that we all got a responsibility to see that we can widen out the survey and the samples by getting other communities involved and not just hugging the sort of internet sphere for ourselves, but widen it out so that other people can be involved in all of this. So it's a challenge really to all of us to make it wider.
Thank you. And yeah.
Hi, Kanishka Narayan, A4E. I suppose I find absolutely spot on and exciting the stuff about sort of linking patient opinion stuff with the co-design processes we've talked about. But I want to talk more about the sort of the fact check type story. I find quite, I suppose, concerning and somewhat dodgy many claims that there are a bunch of facts which kind of exist and you sort of clarify these and you can get to a better policymaking process or better outcomes. It seems to me sort of apart from the straightforward lies and matters of propriety of political behavior, on the key matters of policy, you know, I've just been reading the DWP report into whether work experience works or not. It's a hugely complex thing to do. Even my introductory econometrics doesn't allow me to sort of figure out the precise p-value and level of credibility there. These are not facts. A lot of these aggregated, a lot of this aggregation is done in a way which relies on a very particular sort of compromise between different p-values, different levels of statistical significance. How do you convey that complexity and sort of go away from just saying here's the truth or here's the sort of lie and we're going to do a fact check on these very important things? And I think a lot of decisions in policy in particular lie in that sort of sphere rather than the sphere of straightforward David Cameron or Gordon Brown lies.
Okay, I'm afraid that will have to be a rhetorical question.
can I make a really, really quick point?
Half a sentence, yeah.
Really, really quick, just say that we don't always do fact or fiction. We do have middle dial, specifically for those occasions where it's not something that you can judge as either right or wrong. And also, we do these explainers as well, which don't actually have a fact or fiction rating. It's just like helping people find their way through a complicated policy. So.
Great. Well, thank you all for the comments or questions. I think the next few years are going to be fascinating. The UK is one of the pioneers worldwide in the amount of data being generated and made open and available. I think it really does raise the question of who and how will that be used and interpreted, which is by no means self-evident. There's a policy side to this. There's also the technology side. I mean, we as Nesta are very involved in things like Code for Europe and the different things with programmers trying to create useful tools for citizens to make sense of data. It still feels like we're a little way away from what one version of this debate, whereby a government introduces a new policy, produces lots of open data on it, and then citizens show whether it's working or not ahead of government. That hasn't happened yet, and may still be a few years away, but is an intriguing thought. I'm going to leave the last word to Jill to promote the next event. If you can get the mic to work.
If I can get the mic to work, which I can. Thank you all very much. Thank you to terrific panel and terrific chair. So if you want to show your thanks to them. So I said that this was the third of four, so those of you that are statistically literate, which may mean you don't work in government, you will have worked out that there therefore is a fourth of four, and that's on the 23rd of May, same day number, different day of the week, different time, 4:30 to 6, so we're trialling multiple different time slots in our family-friendly series. That is going to feature Kern Toilings, who is the director of the Netherlands Central Planning Bureau, which sounds incredibly obscure, but they are the people who do the evaluations of Dutch, both policies of the Dutch government, but also the Dutch opposition. And he's going to be talking about what they do, and we've got three discussants. We have Robert Schoot, who heads our own Office for Budget Responsibility. We have Kevin Collins, who now heads up the Education Endowment Foundation, which has a £125 million grant from the Department of Education to run 10 years worth of looking at what works in helping disadvantage in education. And finally, Gareth Davis from the Cabinet Office, Director of the Office of Civil Society, who is heading up the work within government, trying to make into reality the Cabinet Secretary's Guardian comment about establishing a What Works Institute in the UK. So that's on the 23rd of May. Invitations will be going out. If you don't think you're regularly on our list, make sure you fill in one of our forms. And finally, thank you all very much for coming and spending your lunchtime with us.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.